Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to the January call from Nebraska Court of Appeals. My name is Larry Welch from Plattsmouth, Nebraska. I'm pleased to be joined here to my right by Judge Frankie Moore, Chief Judge Frankie Moore from North Platte, and Judge Dave Arterburn from Papillion. We have a full slate of cases this morning. There's six on the call, so we would kindly ask that you wait till your case is called and then please approach. We would like to remind everybody that this, the very public nature of these proceedings, these things are live streamed, so that if there's any confidential or sensitive information, that you remain cognizant of that today in connection with your oral arguments. And we'll get started here this morning with case number 19-0124. That's Christensen versus Sherbeck. Please approach. Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. This is a negligence action involving an automobile accident on June 1st, 2012, in which Mr. Albert Sherbeck was driving home eastbound on Highway 2, crossed the center line, and hit a van full of Broken Bow High School basketball players and their two coaches head-on in the westbound lane, completely in the westbound lane. Both Mr. Sherbeck and the two coaches, Coach Harvey and Coach Blum, were killed in the accident, and the seven passenger students, athletes, were hurt in various degrees. Our client, Chad Christensen, was hurt with a severe brain injury, and that's what brings us to the court in Broken Bow and what brings us here today. The case was tried together with a political subdivision tort claims act against the school district. The jury was going to act in a capacity. We'll have that case next. That's the next case. The court threw out the Broken Bow School District that directed verdict, and we'll talk about that. In this case, there is no cross appeal. The issue in this case is pretty simple. It's a sudden loss of consciousness case. We only have two cases in the last 26 years in Nebraska on this. Storjohn, which sets out the parameters of sudden loss of consciousness, says, one, you have to prove that there was, in fact, a sudden loss of consciousness. Then, if you do prove that, the question is, was that loss of consciousness foreseeable? But you don't get to the second issue unless you prove the first issue. And then we have Nelson versus Jancy, I'm not sure how to pronounce that. And that's where a woman was observed driving, and she was in a seatbelt. She slumped over to the right, her head dangled, she veered off to the left and caused an accident. That was witnessed by somebody. The courts say you don't need expert testimony. Loss of consciousness is an objective fact. You either have it or you don't have it. So loss of consciousness is the key. It's not whether loss of consciousness comes from epilepsy or a heart condition or what the condition is. It's, was there an objective finding or facts that would allow you to get to a loss of consciousness? In this case, Coach Harvey couldn't testify. Coach Blum couldn't testify. Chad himself didn't remember anything about the accident. Austin Reynolds, another student in the vehicle, didn't remember anything about the accident. Two people were driving home from Broken Bow after lunch. They were back about two blocks, they said, and they said they couldn't see inside the cab. So there is no objective evidence that Mr. Sherbeck ever lost consciousness.
Is it required to be objective evidence?
Well, it has to either be objective evidence or it has to be the kind of circumstantial evidence combined with expert evidence that gets you to a submissible case. Here we don't have that. And we go to, in this case, what the defendant tried to do was they hired experts and said, in both cases, the two cardiologists said, in their opinion, he suffered a sudden cardiac death. Well, the court correctly found, under Daubert, that there wasn't enough evidence to actually testify that. There's no statistical evidence. He clearly had a heart condition, but there's no evidence. Judge Noakes found, that there's no evidence that he actually had a sudden cardiac death or that he actually lost sudden consciousness.
But she did allow them to testify that there was a risk of,
exactly,
of sudden cardiac death.
And our point is, until you prove that there is no actual loss of consciousness, that goes to the issue of foreseeability. It should never have come in. It was irrelevant. It was irrelevant that he had a history of heart issues, because there was no finding that he had lost consciousness. Remember in Storjohn, the defendant himself said, I must have lost consciousness. And the court said, that's not enough. And so in this case, all you have is circumstantial evidence. So we go to Larson, we go to Roskopf. Those two cases are the where you use expert testimony cases. And there in Larson, the Supreme Court said, if you have some circumstantial evidence, you might be able to tack on expert witness testimony, but you can't tack it on unless the circumstantial evidence makes it more probable that the event actually happened. It can't be just speculating, risk or conjecture. In other words, did he fall asleep? Was he distracted? He had just navigated a corner, and he came around, he was close to home, and he was looking at his own fields that he rented out.
Well, we don't know that.
We don't.
Well, right. I mean, he could have been. Well, I certainly would admit that we don't know what happened inside that cab. But it wasn't our burden to prove what happened inside that cab. They had to prove a loss of consciousness. She said the doctors couldn't speculate. That's what she said. They can't speculate that he lost consciousness. But then she instructed the jury to speculate. She gave them the information. They had had this history, which only goes to the issue of foreseeability. We objected because that's not relevant until there's a loss of consciousness, until there's enough evidence to have a submissive
case. Well, wasn't there? There was a number of other pieces of circumstantial evidence that wasn't there with respect to the lack of blood on the airbag, the lack of braking, the sudden move across the center line, the period of normal driving for several minutes that the witnesses saw. So doesn't that support between the two of those things?
No more than it supports whether that he went to sleep, that he was awake until he went to sleep. No more than it supports that he became distracted. No more than it supports that he dropped his phone.
Why isn't that the jury's call, though?
Because the issue of it, because it's not a submissible case. You can't ask the jury to select between various options that are all equally available based on the circumstantial evidence. We don't know what happened in there. We have these circumstantial bits, but they all lead in equal measure to various conclusions, and we don't let juries speculate.
Don't we let juries...
Not speculate.
I'm going to take you into a different scenario, and maybe this isn't the right way to go, but a lot of our homicide cases, there's no eyewitness other than whoever did it, and they're proven by circumstantial evidence, and we let the juries make that determination. So why would this be any different?
Well, first of all, it's a civil case, and I think the circumstantial evidence operates differently in the criminal sphere than it does in the civil case. And we have Larson and we have Roskopf that make it pretty clear that in Larson, the Supreme Court said, we're not going to let people guess, and we're not even going to let experts guess at that, and they didn't give a submissible case. The fact that they kept out the expert testimony, they didn't let the jury then speculate where that fire started. It could have started near the boiler. It could have started somewhere else. There just wasn't adequate facts. That's an identical case to this, where there's circumstantial evidence that it started near the boiler, but the same evidence leads that it could have started somewhere else. So you don't let the jury do it. In that case, they said the expert can't testify, can't provide the missing link, and we're not going to submit that case to the jury. That's what we have in this case.
And that's what case you're referring to?
That's the Larson case.
The Larson case.
Last year's case, Justice Papik wrote that case.
And so that's your support for your argument that you can't use the doctor's even testimony about the risk, and that sudden cardiac death is precipitated by loss of consciousness to establish loss of consciousness.
Right. You only get there if there was an established loss of consciousness, and then we would raise that and we would say that it was foreseeable. We would use that evidence to be foreseeable. That would be up to us. Mm-hmm. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal, if that's all right with the court, if there are no other questions right now.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jared Krejci, and I represent Beverly Sherbeck. As you've already seen, this is a circumstantial evidence case. In this case, the jury believed that Mr. Sherbeck suffered from loss of consciousness that caused this accident. Our theory of what the loss of consciousness was some type of sudden cardiac event. On this appeal, the two questions are whether there was sufficient evidence presented of a sudden loss of consciousness, which took the jury's decision out of the realm of speculation. So that is the standard for the first question as of the instruction. It is whether the jury was supplied with enough evidence to make a decision based on their realm of knowledge that could be made without speculating. So I do want to stress that, and we believe that the trial judge was correct in that determination. The second issue on this appeal is whether the opinions of Drs. Mahoney and McGowan that Mr. Sherbeck was at a high risk of a sudden cardiac event, whether that was relevant. The judge determined that that type of opinion will assist the jury in understanding the issues involved in this case, and we submit that the judge was correct in making that determination. In any event, that decision is reviewed under an abuse of discretion, and it's our position that the trial judge was correct and absolutely did not abuse her discretion on that issue. To begin with, on the first question, as of the instruction, I view this case similar to when the Court of Appeals or a trial judge reviews a differential diagnosis by an expert. In the past, on differential diagnosis opinions, you said that you need to be able to rule in everything that could have happened and then one by one rule out the possibilities until you're left with something reasonable that is not speculation. In this case, the jury was presented with enough circumstantial evidence to rule in all of the different possibilities that may have caused this accident, and based on their determination, they could logically infer that other causes of the accident were ruled out and you're left with a sudden loss of consciousness. Our theory, based on the evidence, was that the explanation for the sudden loss of consciousness was that Mr. Sherbeck had a sudden cardiac event and he was incapacitated or dead at the time of the accident.
So can you respond to appellant's argument that you shouldn't be allowed to rely upon expert evidence to establish that loss of consciousness?
Well, I think, I'm not trying to argue with you, Your Honor, but I think that the appellant's argument is that this expert testimony of a high risk of a sudden cardiac event shouldn't have came in because it goes to foreseeability. Is that what you're saying, Your Honor?
Yeah, I'm just asking you to respond to that.
Yes. Well, first, I disagree with the reading of Storjohn that you need to somehow bifurcate the trial and only have an issue of loss of consciousness determined by the jury and then have some type of separate issue of determination. It's my view that that is within the trial judge's discretion to hold her trial as she did, and that was not objected to the way that the trial was held. The second issue is that this opinion that Mr. Sherbeck was at a high risk of a sudden cardiac event, it is relevant and probative on the issue of a sudden loss of consciousness. If the opinion was Mr. Sherbeck is at a high risk for a sudden cardiac event and there is a 99% likelihood that he will have this event within a year, that would certainly go to whether or not it happened. The opinion that Mr. Sherbeck is at a high risk of a sudden cardiac event causing a sudden loss of consciousness is very probative to the issue of sudden loss of consciousness itself. So that's why it was offered by our experts. So that's how I would respond to that, Your Honor. I did want to touch on some of the circumstantial evidence. There was circumstantial evidence that Mr. Sherbeck wasn't speeding, and he didn't speed as a habit. So we're able to toss out that alternative explanation. The evidence from the witnesses behind that he jumped or suddenly swerved allows a jury, based on their realm of knowledge of driving, this is within their province, It allows a jury to logically infer that he was not falling asleep by weaving, that he was not becoming distracted by something. It also allows the inference of death or unconsciousness. This type of determination is within a jury's realm of knowledge. There was evidence from Mrs. Sherbeck that Mr. Sherbeck did not fall asleep when he drove. There was evidence from Mrs. Sherbeck that if Mr. Sherbeck would look at a field, as farmers do, he would stop his pickup and look. In that case, that wasn't happening. So you can start to throw out distraction, sleeping. There was no obvious and objective evidence from the crash that would show that Mr. Sherbeck would have passed away in the absence of the heart condition. And what I'm getting at is that the cab of the pickup was not completely crushed. The officer who investigated the scene testified that the blood was consistent with facial injuries from the airbag, but it's not obvious and objective that Mr. Sherbeck died because of the collision. So that the jury can throw, that starts to get into the inference that the jury can draw that there was a sudden loss of consciousness. Trooper Newmiller, who investigated afterwards, stated that Mr. Sherbeck's positioning in his vehicle was consistent with sitting behind the wheel. The jury can infer that Mr. Sherbeck was not reaching down to grab something. They can throw out that alternate hypothesis. Trooper Newmiller testified that Mr. Sherbeck was not using a cell phone. The jury can throw out that alternate hypothesis. Trooper Newmiller said that Mr. Sherbeck's last phone use was 4 or 5 minutes before the accident while he was driving. The jury can infer from that that he was awake at that time. At that point, just based on throwing things out, you get to the point of saying, well, what else could have caused this? And we're starting to be left with the sudden loss of consciousness. The key piece of evidence that Judge Arterburn touched on was the lack of blood on the airbag. The appellant's witness, Trooper Newmiller, testified that the blood was consistent with Mr. Sherbeck's heart not beating at the time of the accident. And with that evidence, at that point, it's sufficient to submit on a sudden loss of consciousness.
What about the experts for the plaintiffs allowed to testify to in this regard?
In this regard?
With regard to what happened with Mr. Sherbeck.
Well, the plaintiffs did have an expert that said, based on what I've reviewed, you can't tell what happened. He could have fallen asleep. He could have been distracted. But as you can see at trial, there was evidence that allowed the jury to toss out those types of alternate explanations. And at this point, with the standard of review, none of the appellant's experts matter because the jury could have completely disregarded. So that would be my response to that, Judge Arterburn. With that, I would like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
There's no rebuttal.
I'm sorry. I'll keep going. Well, let me continue then. And our experts, Drs. McGowan and Mahoney, did testify, and their testimony was relevant and helped assist the jury in understanding what happened. That's part of Daubert's relevant standard. Our experts did not have to testify, this is what happened. I can say that within a reasonable degree of medical certainty. They can testify about heart conditions to help the jury understand. And in that case, they did. They said that he was at a high risk. They said that this type of event happens nearly instantaneously, and that helps the jury understand what they decided happened.
And I'm going back to the use of the expert testimony to establish the probability of loss of consciousness. And appellant's counsel mentioned the Larson case from last year. I just wanted to give you an opportunity to respond to that if you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honor. The Larson case and the Roskopf Dairy case, those are about causation. And in those cases, this court or the Supreme Court are analyzing a different question. This essentially is not about causation. We need to show that Mr. Sherbeck had a sudden loss of consciousness. It's not necessary that we show exactly how it happened. So the issue of causation in those cases, and it ties into the larger issue of whether the jury is allowed to speculate. And so that's the larger realm that we're in. With the evidence that was submitted, the jury was allowed to use their common knowledge to come to a decision that was not speculation, that was rational, and because of that, that jury instruction was correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
How much time did he go over there?
47 seconds.
I think it's a minute 47.
Well, he meant over.
No.
So added together, so what did he have left, and then how far did he go over?
There was 1 minute and 46 seconds left of rebuttal.
Okay.
And the appellee went over 47 seconds.
Okay. Add that together, so that's his rebuttal time.
Your Honor, I would just point out that...
Sure,
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Oh, it's my fault. I'm sorry.
Ready?
Your Honor, circumstantial evidence has to lead to a conclusion that is reasonably probable, not merely possible. In this case, all we have are possibilities. They only point to possibilities and not one more than the other. For example, sitting behind the wheel proves he didn't slump over. He was found directly behind the wheel. He was not in a seatbelt. He didn't slump over, right or left. He was found immediately behind the wheel. That's circumstantial evidence that he was clearly awake. Lack of a lot of blood, that means he was killed instantly, not that as a result of the accident, not that his heart stopped before that. That's all speculation, and under Larson, I submit to you, and I would submit to the court that a careful examination of the record and all these things, Mr. Sherbeck actually said he had gone to sleep before while he was driving. So, you know, they're just, the record is, as explained to you by counsel, is not exactly as he said it was. But I would point to the fact that circumstantial evidence must lead to a reasonably probable single result, not a panoply of results. And that's the problem in this case. One or the other, we don't know what happened. We never will. There was simply a failure of proof on the loss of consciousness defense. They didn't prove the first element. We should never have gotten to foreseeability. That made Mr. Sherbeck's medical history irrelevant to the question of whether or not he ever lost consciousness, and it should never be admitted. And I would just submit to the court that everybody my age that has a little bit of heart problem, that has a heart history, it's in their medical, if I get into an accident on the way home and I don't survive that accident, defense counsel is going to raise this issue if that's the case. If you can prove through my medical history that I may have died and put that before a jury and let them speculate when you wouldn't let the doctor speculate, then it seems to me we've got this backwards. The court did instruct them on negligence and then said, do you find that Mr. Sherbeck was negligent? They said yes. Did you find Mrs. Sherbeck was negligent? Said yes. Then she'd instructed on sudden medical emergency. NJI says you shouldn't instruct on that, but she did specifically instruct on that, led them to that, and they said, if you don't, then you don't get to damages. So I would submit to the court that in this case, what we need is an order remanding the case, and because of the correct and incorrect jury instruction, and send it back to the trial court for a trial on the damages. And without any other questions, I'd be happy to stand down.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted. Okay, the next case. Case number 19-0125, Christensen versus Broken Bow Public Schools.